This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with SG2 experts and industry thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. We're always looking for new ideas and topics from our listeners, so please reach out, share your ideas. You can email us at sg2perspectives@sg2.com or connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can find links to all that in the show notes. Now, on to this week's episode. Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. We're your hosts, Trevor Durin, Kelly Richard. We're also going to play experts today, along with our real experts, Tori Ritchie and Brian Esser. We're going to talk about a tool that the four of us created together, our insurance coverage forecast, because that forecast brings in inputs from commercial and government payers. We're going to talk about the thinking, research, learnings, and conclusions and assumptions to build that model. So Tori, introduce us to the model. Explain what it is and what it does.
So the elevator pitch for this forecast is essentially a projection for the shifts in sources of health insurance coverage over the next 5 years. It's a population-based zip code level forecast that's available for the nation, and it disaggregates trends down to the county level that takes into account a variety of different demographic factors. So this is the sixth year of this tool refresh, and the task at hand was this group trying to figure out how do we incorporate COVID into insurance enrollment, and how's that going to impact enrollment for the next 5 years?
Great. Just to give the listeners a little bit of orientation, how do people use this? How do our clients, health systems, typically incorporate this type of information into what they do?
It's typically leveraged by strategy teams, and in some cases, the financial teams of health systems across the country. And really, the point is to just provide additional information on who's in their market. Because of different policy changes coming into effect, can their market expect to see growth in Medicaid or Medicare Advantage, for example? And then allows them to really get ahead of the game in terms of thinking through different marketing strategies, how to target and do outreach for those different cohorts.
Right. And I'd expect that if you're thinking about revenue over the next 5 years, you would plug in what the market looks like in terms of payer mix, and then you'd be able to get an idea of how your revenue is going to behave, correct?
Totally. This is particularly important for states that have recently expanded Medicaid. So trying to wrap your head around how much can we expect that Medicaid population to grow? What might then be the implications on our bottom line as we see growth of that cohort?
Makes sense.
Kelly had the toughest draw in the straws here, because we gave her a commercial, which, face it, that subsidizes everything else that our health system members do. And that's the place with the most uncertainty related to COVID. So Kelly, you want to start with commercial, and then we can talk about kind of the other building blocks beneath it?
I raised my hand to take the toughest one because, first of all, commercials, something that's sort of more interesting to me based on the fact that I usually cover our employer activity as well. It seemed like a really big task to take on. So the way I kind of approached it was thinking through the types of commercial insurance and what are the wild cards here. The place that we started was our payer mix forecast, where we were doing this really short-term forecast, really focused on unemployment. The idea here was, what is unemployment going to do? And we obviously saw a huge dip when the pandemic hit. Since then, it's really been a story about recovery. And we wanted to figure out, if we start at the end of 2020, which is kind of where our really granular forecast ended, what's the rate of recovery over the next 5 years? When do we get back to where we were pre-pandemic, if at all, in the next 5 years? This was maybe one of the trickier parts because we're trying to think, does this compare to the Great Recession? We really took a look back in history over the last 100 years, and how often do recessions happen? How do they affect unemployment? And how quickly does recovery happen? How is that different when we're thinking through what the pandemic looks like? And I think that a lot of folks have been like, the economy has done way, way better than we had really ever expected. And something that we've talked about is unemployment and the general assessment of how well the economy is doing are different things. We talked about this with Steve Jenkins a couple weeks ago. He said, the stock market's doing great. The economy is in the dumps. For anyone just thinking generally about the economy, we still think that unemployment is probably the best measure of that. And that's really what we're focusing on here. So we aren't expecting the economy to bounce back immediately. It's going to take a couple of years. What was the year, Tori, that we finally had it bouncing back?
2023.
Initially, we said, oh, by the end of 2021, we'll be back where we were. But in looking back from the Great Recession, I think it took something like 8 years to get back to where we were originally. So we figured doing a 1 year rebound was probably unrealistic. And we really had to think through not just were there underlying issues in the economy that are pushing us in this direction, but the longer that we stay in a recession, the more impact that we're going to have. And then it's slow climb back to where we were previously over the next couple of years. So that's the macro trend. Then we looked at some of the things that the specific sectors of commercial insurance. We're thinking about what happens with high deductible health plans. What about HMOs? And from a PPO perspective, we're starting to just continue to see the networks narrow, even though they may still be called a PPO plan, which people may not typically associate with a PPO. You think PPO choice, but there's some other underlying factors there that we're starting to get at. From the high deductible health plan perspective, Trevor, I think we had a pretty interesting conversation about that.
We were at both ends of the spectrum. Yeah.
So basically, the idea here, and when we're talking about the employer space, we think to ourselves, high deductible health plans are squeezing consumers. People are getting less care, lowering utilization. They're not really choosing to get care that they probably need. So outcomes are going to be worse. But at the end of the day, I think what we came back to was that employers probably don't care that much. Most of the workforce changes jobs every couple of years. So we think that employers are still going to push toward reducing costs in the easiest way that they can, and high deductible health plans are going to continue to grow.
Yeah, fair, right? Everyone wants their employees to be healthy, but there's not a lot of programs that have shown that in 1 year or 2 years, they can make an impact. Making big longitudinal wellness investments, it's been kind of a fad that hasn't paid off, but high deductible health plans have at least clear data showing that premiums are a little lower for the employer.
They'll continue to grow at least in the next 5 years. There probably will be a point at which you're going to see some of these more progressive employers start to push back on that. But we're not seeing a ton of really interesting, innovative stuff in that employer space like we had hoped. I think one of the more disappointing things that I saw happen was the breakdown of Haven, which we kind of saw coming as they weren't really putting anything forward. In terms of employers pushing some sort of activist perspective that could reduce the cost of commercial insurance, we haven't seen much to date. It's still going to be an area that some of those traditional levers that they can pull are probably going to continue to be optimized over the next 2 to 5 years.
Yeah. And one thing I'd throw in, Kelly, it was interesting talking to folks working in the employer benefits space, is hearing from employers that, hey, we saw a dip in healthcare spend just due to the fact of the employees had an aversion to showing up for anything for most of the year. I haven't been to see an actual doctor, at least in 12 months, probably longer. And the only ones in my family have shown up to an actual clinic are my kids for their annual wellness visits. The employers are saying, okay, I saw this massive dip. Maybe there was a lot of care that we were paying for that wasn't maybe necessary or overutilized. And oh, by the way, my employees are totally fine doing a Zoom with their doctor, and that should cost me less. So it's not just those large ones like the Nikes and the Disney Worlds and Boeings that have the clout in their market to leverage a narrow network. But we're also seeing these mid and smaller employers say, hey, okay, let's come together, build our coalitions. Coalitions have been around for a long time, but let's start thinking about how do we pull these lives together and force our local providers to react differently. We want on-site clinics, virtual, everything you've talked to in the past, Kelly, just let's really bring that in-house because our employees are interested and willing to adopt that because they're fearful of showing up. Now is the time the employers can push the envelope and providers need to be ready to respond.
The other maybe wild card that I think we should probably address, and it might be a good segue into thinking through the exchanges and Medicare and Medicaid, is the thought that, hey, what if we get a public option and we see several employers offload their employees onto the exchanges? That could cause a pretty significant dip in the commercial sector. What we came to is that it's pretty unlikely, at least in the next year or so, just because from a legislative and policy perspective, it's probably not the focus. The focus is vaccines and arms and getting out of our houses. It's like, I don't know that this is going to be first on the list.
As we think about it, we have a unified government now, but even still, this idea that radical policy changes are going to come through, it's likely not going to happen. What's going to pass is going to be stuff that has bipartisan support. Biden will probably concentrate his efforts on shoring up some of the gaps and issues with the Affordable Care Act and with the exchanges, but not focus effort on really investing in and developing that public option at this point.
And Tori, you were on the consulting team a few years ago when we built a lot of modeling around when the exchanges were new. And the devil's totally in the details about demographic segments in the market and what would be impacted. We get to rebuild this model every year. So if there's a new huge option, it's really not going to make an impact until next year anyway. And we'll have the details right to be able to make it real. At this point, it'd be such speculation that it's not worth it.
In our year ahead webinar, the public option was pretty low on the likely list from an SG2 perspective. We didn't want to, as Trevor said, draw that in. If something crazy happens in 2021, and don't get me wrong, it certainly could, we will incorporate that. But all we have is the data that we have for right now, and it didn't seem too likely of a scenario to take place.
Right. Another policy thing that we didn't really bake in is a huge Medicaid expansion, but we know it's going to happen in a few states. And beyond that, we didn't do a ton of creative massaging around the Medicaid forecast, right, Brian?
Yeah, we didn't. Tori was one of my key guides here in Medicaid. So we had a couple of states expand, which was expected, but it's interesting because we would expect the Medicaid ranks to grow just based on the economy, people falling off in challenging situations. So we did bump it going into this year, and it's probably higher than our previous forecast. But that's offset to a degree. We haven't transitioned to the Biden administration, but there was the current administration encouraging restricting Medicaid, work requirements, and others. So we saw a slowdown of growth of the Medicaid recently, but that's most likely going to flip back to Medicaid growth, or at least an encouragement of Medicaid growth at the state level. The issue, and we all know, Medicaid and states in general have to be budget neutral. Medicaid is a key expense for them, along with education and other social programs like that at the state level. And they're going to have a funding challenge at the end of the day. The states do not have the tax revenue coming in. So that may mean Medicaid rolls on a volume basis will expand. But how do you either cut rates, limit benefits? There has to be something that gives within these budgets to really keep the population serviced, but in a manageable way. So that's the concern on the Medicaid side. And then it goes back to, okay, if Medicaid is not sustainable, how do you open up exchanges, Medicare for all, you have public options, other things that would help offset the pressure financially on the state budgets will be interesting. Trevor, you and I talked about this. We are fans of The Economist. So some states and regions will probably be harder hit. Oil type industry areas, tourism, our friends in Atlantic City, Vegas, areas that are going to lag behind the overall recovery just based on the industries that are their prime economic drivers are probably going to be more Medicaid heavy or at least focused for a longer term. This is at least a state, if not regional issue for sure.
And Brian, to build off of, you know, state budgets and Medicaid being one area that, of course, is going to be in the crosshairs, and there's going to be a little bit of a red state, blue state difference in how they address it. But one thing that many have already done is look at how they're handling retiree healthcare obligations. And MA Group is a huge driver behind our Medicare forecast. I mean, MA Group was the fastest growing segment of Medicare Advantage in the past 3 or 4 years. It's kind of blind to a lot of people because you don't have a lot of visibility into which employers it is or if it's state teachers, but states like Connecticut, New Jersey, Alabama flipped their teachers unions, or at least a huge chunk of their retiree healthcare obligations to MA. And all of a sudden it bumps in the state where maybe 24 hours from getting the January enrollment data for MA, I only hit refresh 3 or 4 times a day waiting for that new data. But the expectation is that group is going to see a big bump this year. We don't call it out specifically as like a segment in our forecast, but it's a driver behind continued Medicare Advantage growth. If you look historically, the last 5 years, traditional fee-for-service Medicare enrollment is really close to flat. And we're predicting that's going to continue for the next 5 years. And the growth associated with the silver tsunami, the baby boom retirement, is mostly getting all picked up by MA. The total pie is growing and MA is growing. And so that component, that fee for service has been pretty flat, gets kind of lost sometimes. That's a trend that'll continue. We see MA enrollment continuing to grow, although we don't forecast a huge bump this year. I think early in the summer, there was some speculation that if the economy is looking really bad, Kelly outlined a great differentiation that economy and the stock market aren't the same thing, but face it, a lot of retirees pay close attention to the stock market because that's where a lot of their assets are tied up. If that's in bad shape, moving over to MA just based on lower premiums is going to be an easy sell for people. I've at least heard some of the early expectations around that cool off a little bit through the fall, maybe just because in the fall, the unemployment in the economy looked like it was getting better as people were making those decisions during open enrollment. So we don't expect a huge jump this year, but there's been a big jump every year for the last few years, and we kind of expect that incremental growth to continue.
Quick question, Trevor. I think this has sort of been a point of debate on our team, or and I've kind of heard different things from different pieces of data about who it is that's joining MA. So is it just new enrollees, or are we going to expect to start to see folks that are in traditional Medicare move over to MA because they're just being stretched, they're on a fixed income, and the economy's bad?
Thanks for reminding me of that point, because I know we've talked about it. In Medicare, generally payers think about it as people getting traditional Medicare plus SUP, that's like highest income. Then there's people who enroll in Medicare Advantage, which is kind of middle of the road. And then there's people who stick with just traditional Medicare, which is typically lower income. Of course, there's duals mixed into that, but that's kind of the general three buckets. Last year, 300,000 people moved from traditional MA plus SUP into Medicare Advantage. From a marketing and working with brokers and a channel perspective, that's how payers always thought of SUP as a place where they could pull people into MA. Even when it's the same payer offering both products, you're moving from the seventh floor to the sixth floor of the United Healthcare building. But this year, there's some great consumer research done throughout the summer that showed people in SUP and people in MA felt pretty confident that the health plan they had was going to work well during the pandemic for them. They felt like they still had access, they had good virtual options, communication was good. Now, a follow-up question saying, why are you confident? What have they done around COVID that's been helpful? No one could really answer that, but face it, it's a feeling. They felt good. They're not going to shop as much. This was the expectation. But people with just traditional Medicare expressed a lot of dissatisfaction, higher than most years, in their health plan. They didn't feel confident that they had the coverage they needed. And so there's an expectation that this year, payers pivoted that marketing push to focus more on people in just traditional Medicare. That's probably a segment that's going to go for $0 premium plans. And that's where they're hoping to see a big shift.
Yeah, we're going to experiment here with some direct contracting. And Brian, maybe you want to comment on that a little bit. What will the changes that are going to happen with direct contracting and some of the changes in the incentives there going to change the way that those in traditional Medicare experience care delivery enough to make them, as Trevor said, kind of feel good about the plan that they have?
Yeah, it definitely has the opportunity to, because direct contracting, especially the most recently released geographic model where a provider and or an insurer takes responsibility for the fee-for-service population in a region. So it's not based on attribution through your provider base. That model has enough flexibility that starts to mimic MA, right? You're going to have incentives for the beneficiaries, lower premiums, deductibles, as well as vouchers for things like travel, food delivery, all that that you would expect more in an MA type program. So the flexibilities are there. The question is, can the providers organize themselves enough and implement these in a way that an MA, like a United, is so used to doing that it starts to feel similar, if not better, to an MA platform? And we're excited about it because the fee-for-service now has an option like that, and it could be interesting. Devil's in the details and the outcomes will be interesting to operationalize. My one question back to Trevor is MA going to bump just because people aren't traveling as much anymore? And that idea of Medicare fee-for-service and going wherever you want and access being totally open, since I'm not going anywhere anyway, is MA more attractive on a narrow network or restricted access point of view?
This is anecdotal, but I'll push back on people aren't traveling because my folks who are not 70 and over, so they're in the second phase, they're already setting up travel plans as soon as they're vaccinated. Unfortunately, I don't think this is going to be a multi-year trend of people in that MA shoppers thinking, I'm probably going to be close to home. That could have been a huge driver, right? Because traditionally snowbirds just don't fit well with MA networks. But like my in-laws who are snowbirds and super high risk and should not be leaving their house are absolutely traveling to their winter house in Arizona. It's just when you're making these decisions for years at a time, it seems like people are expecting that this year they're going to be sort of back to their old travel plan.
I feel so excited for their vacation for that.
If they're coming here to watch my kids, I'm all for it. This was perfect. Thanks for running through some of the thinking. Our debates were more heated than this sometimes during the real negotiation, but I'm glad we all got to an outcome that we're happy with. So thanks for joining. Thanks to our listeners. Everyone stay safe.
This has been another episode of SG2 Perspectives. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and don't forget to rate and review. We'd love to hear from you. Please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter at SG2 Healthcare. You can also reach us via email at sg2perspectives@sg2.com. Reach out and let us know what healthcare trends are most important to you. Please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.